Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to another jam-packed edition of The Interviews. First up, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? Not Hayley Bennett and Jack Whitehall, that's for sure. Just a little joke there. They are the stars of Tina Garavi's new film, Virginia Woolf's Night and Day, inspired by the Virginia Woolf novel, in which Bennett plays a young English woman who yearns to be an astronomer in Edwardian England, but constantly butts heads with the buttheads who think that a woman should know her place. Whitehall plays her well-meaning, if slightly bumbling, childhood friend turned suitor. The film is out now in cinemas, and I spoke to Bennett and Whitehall over Zoom just the other day about anti-chemistry, Edwardian improv, and of course, Nando's. Nando's comes up on this podcast so often, I can't even begin to tell you, and now I'm hungry. Anyway, here it is. Enjoy. Hayley Bennett, Jack Whitehall, how the devil are you both? Welcome to the Emperor Podcast.
Thank you very much for having us on.
Thank you.
Excellent. Whereabouts are you at the moment?
In a very swanky Soho Members Club.
Is it the original Soho? Was this Groucho Club?
No, it's the Union Club.
Was it always the Union Club?
It feels like it was probably always the Union Club.
Very bohemian. Chic.
For all of the press, they've put us in quite sort of old-timey places, which has been very nice. It's immersive.
Wolf core.
So yes, we're here surrounded by watercolors and
books.
It's lovely. Fine furniture, taxidermy, yeah.
And so there's stuffed animals looking at you right now.
Yes, there's one very scary stuffed animal in front of me. Oh no, that's my publicist. Sorry.
And yet you're both in modern day dress, so it doesn't quite take you back to filming this movie, I guess.
It's much warmer.
We were in Newcastle in December. We had one jaunt into Newcastle in our full period costume into a Nando's at one point during production, which is quite enjoyable because Hayley said that she'd never had a Nando's, and I was like, well, this needs to change immediately. So we practically shut down the set and said everyone needs to down tools so we can walk over the road into the Nando's and try some piri piri sauce. Yes, Edwardian attire.
That's a piri period sauce, I think.
Yes, piri period sauce, exactly. We got some quite funny looks from the other patrons.
I can imagine you did. Hayley, okay, there's a lot to dig into there. So you'd never been to Nando's before at all?
Never.
Why?
Well, I mean, I've been living here for 8 years.
Yeah.
And I never had Nando's. Okay. That was a mistake. I was missing out.
But this feels like a deliberate choice that you had made to not Nando.
I wasn't on a Nando strike.
Sounds like you were. Sounds like you were more of a Nando-n't than a Nando, I think. So once you had it, did you enjoy it? Have you been back since in your own garb?
I did, although our costume designer Esther was really hardcore, and I just saw her like leering at me because I was shoving like hot, like don't spill that hot sauce. I don't know what accent that was. She was just giving me like dirty looks.
She was
shaking her head.
Terrifying.
She was terrifying.
Yeah, that's not a conducive way to enjoy a Nando's when you're being death stared by a German costume designer from over the road.
She saw me the other day and she goes, oh, you look much better. You're very thin now. What happened? Thanks. Hi, good to see you. No more Nando's.
No more Nando's, yeah.
That's the key. I promise we're going to talk about the film in a second, but Jack, are you a big Nando fan, big Nando head?
Well, yeah, I was. I mean, my sort of famous Nando's story is that I was given the Nando's black card in my early 20s when I just broken through on television, and I was so excited. It felt like, for me, getting an Oscar. Like my whole career had been building to this moment, and I got the Nando's card, but I was still living in Manchester at the time in a student house with all of my friends, and I would go there and I would take my Nando's black card to the local Nando's in Fallowfield, and you were allowed 4 free meals, but I worked out a hack, which is that a whole chicken counted as a meal. So I would bring about 20 students in every day, order 4 whole chickens for all of them, and just feed the 5,000. And I was the first celebrity ever to have the Nando's black card taken away from me because I abused the privilege. but kept a lot of students fed.
Yeah, I think you should be rewarded with more Nando's Black Cards, to be quite frank. That's the ultimate accolade, by the way. That's when you know you've made it.
We really better get a life of Nando's after this.
Yeah. I've been banging on and dropping that story for nearly a decade, and they've never offered me another one.
There's probably a lesson in there somewhere. I don't know, but you've probably had this question an awful lot, given that this is Virginia Woolf's Night and Day. But for both of you going into this, were either of you afraid of Virginia Woolf? Was this a bit daunting?
Yes, I think so.
Yes and no, because this novel isn't, you know, her most, not many people know about this novel, and it was something, you know, I think it was her, like, it was something that, it was like her adopted child, and she kind of dissociated herself from it in a way. So it didn't feel as daunting as it would be if it were, like, you know, The Lighthouse or The Waves or Orlando, you know.
And in fact, that is definitely true. Like, I've done literary adaptations before, and you have to be pretty stringent with the script, and, you know, it's, the book is gospel, and you need to be really careful about deviating from it too much. But what was great about this is sort of Tina's approach to the material, which was to have fun with it and to make it feel fresh and modern, and, you know, encourage improvisation and trying to find some kind of looseness and, you know, energy in the scenes, which meant that we were given a little bit more free rein than you might have if you were doing a sort of standard period drama. I mean, Justine wrote a fantastic script, so what we were working with was amazing, but, you know, we were given the sort of liberty to sort of extrapolate, and I think that was quite a fun way to be able to do something like this, and not a way that I'd worked in before.
Hayley, I'd seen another interview with you, with Justine, actually, where you talk about having the freedom to improvise, which blows my mind, you know, in a way, because you're improvising within the period as well. So was that difficult for you both to do that?
Yeah, I mean, every now and again, you get something wrong, and you'd be in the middle of a scene, and, you know, say, oh, I'm absolutely gagging for a Nando's or something that wasn't quite, you know, of the period. But it felt really freeing, and it meant that you were
just like a sense of delightful chaos.
Yeah,
and everyone was so game to kind of improvise and have fun, and the fact that it is a comedy, and we just had a, like, had to trust our, you know, fellow filmmakers to, you know, cut out the fat.
Yes, the flabby stuff. Yeah, absolutely. And what made it in? Did any improvs make it in that you can identify as?
Lots of jacks.
There was a few. I like the one about Nancy.
Oh, yes.
I didn't know that. Yeah, that was fun.
I'll be in a city in France.
Being a town in France. Yeah. In a scene that was, like, really not meant to be funny in any way. And I was just like, on one take, can I say this? Because I think it will be funny. And then said it, and some people cracked up. And I was like, well, it's obviously never ending up on the film. But
yeah,
at least I got it out of my system.
About Jack is that he, you know, brings such a, like, a wit and a charm and absurdity to the role. But also underneath all of that is, like, a tremendous heart. And everything that he does, no matter how ridiculous it is, always has this kind of real, he's very genuine.
Thank you.
And of course, Hayley, you know, as are you, but you also had to improvise not just within the period, but
I improv the egg scene where I, like,
yeah, oh, that's smashed.
That wasn't scripted.
Did you just have an egg on you at the time?
It was a breakfast scene, and there was an egg on the table, and I was dealing with disappointment and sitting with my parents, and I just picked up the egg and just started smashing it, and their reaction was so funny. And then the dog came and started eating eggshells, which is great, but I just loved the absurdity of it, and yeah, the freedom to kind of make these choices and, like, to be able to follow your impulses.
Yeah.
To do that as well in another accent is insane. It's like I've had to, you know, use accents in films before, and if ever I deviate from the script, we end up in Jamaica, South Africa. It just goes all over the place. And then any country other than the accent I am attempting. And it was amazing. And was again, like able to sort of be free and loose and make, you know, daring choices. And then also, you know, remain within the accent. And that is just like, yeah, there's my plaudits.
Yeah. Haley, is the accent something you've just picked up naturally as a result of living over here? Or have you always had that in your pocket?
No, it's something I've learned and I've had to unlearn now when I go do American things. And they're like, can you use your American accent? And I'm like, I am using my American accent. What are you talking about? They're like, oh, no, actually, you sound very, very English. I learned my English accent from my 7-year-old daughter, Virginia. So she's starting to read now, which is great. So I could just say, like, how do you say that? So you say that for me? What, mommy? Could you just read that line out for me? So she's my dialect coach.
We were filming in Newcastle, though, so every now and again, because of the local influence, she would veer a bit Geordie. So we would be there, and it would be very RP, and then all of a sudden she'd be like, how are you, man? That's a canny bonnet up there. I was like, oh, no, she's gone again. We're going to have to cut. Went full Jimmy Nail.
You'll never go full Jimmy Nail. That's one thing I've learned over the years. I've got to let you guys go in a second, but the relationship in the film between your characters, Kit and William, is really, really interesting because, you know, William is madly in love with Kit. Kit perhaps isn't so bothered about William. So it's not so much like a kind of will they, won't they. It's kind of a more like will they, no, they won't kind of thing. That's a really interesting chemistry to play.
Will they, won't they?
Yeah. I'm such a beg in it. It was so fun to play that energy and just be like so smitten and besotted and just like, he has this amazing array of reactions to my nonsense. And
I love it that. The pickle in the jar.
The pickle in the jar.
Am I the last pickle in the jar?
You're the loveliest pickle in the jar.
That was a fun
scene. It is just baseballs.
Haley, from your point of view, was that easy to tap into? A sort of, not a repulsion to Jack necessarily, but, you know, you're not accepting.
I think it's the opposite because he's so lovable, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, don't. You know, they can't have, they have great like ick chemistry.
Yeah.
But he's so lovable. It's hard, not, you know, to reject him in that way. It's,
but lovable like a little dog. Maybe like one of those dogs that's got the wheels at the back. It's a bit of a lame dog. Like lovable like that.
Like one of those dogs that you wind up and it just goes around. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. That kind of lovable.
The sort of dog that might be stuffed and on the wall of the place where you are right now.
Yes.
Lovable in a taxidermy, in a wrong kind of taxidermy.
As sexy as taxidermy.
It's a little wonky.
Yes. I think that's in the book, isn't it? William Rodney walked into the room as sexy as taxidermy.
He was as sexy as a wonky stuffed dog.
Oh, yes, you've read the book.
I've read the book. I'm quoting it verbatim. But anyway, on that note, I do have to let you guys go. And presumably, if you are in Soho, you're heading straight to Nando's right now.
Correct. Correct. For a cheeky Nando's.
A little cheeky Nando's. Fantastic. Enjoy that. And thanks for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Good to you. Bye, Chris.
There you go. That was Haley Bennett and Jack Whitehall. And I hope that he, and indeed I, is successful in his pursuit of a Nando's black card. Virginia Woolf's Night and Day is out in cinemas right now. Not out in cinemas right now, but on Sky Cinema instead, is Gus Van Sant's Dead Man's Wire, which tells the story of Tony Caritsis, a guy who in 1977 in Indianapolis held a mortgage broker hostage for 63 hours via a sawn-off shotgun affixed to his hand with a dead man's wire. In other words, a wire that would fire the shotgun at his hostage, killing him instantly should Caritsis himself be killed or incapacitated by the police or anyone else. The film came out in the cinemas a couple of months ago, starring Bill Skarsgård as Caritsis, and I was really impressed by it. I was also super impressed by Cary Elwes's turn as Michael Grable, the first cop on the scene. In fact, and I'm not making this up, I knew that Elwes was in the movie, but honestly didn't recognize him for the first 10 minutes or so, as this is a performance far removed from the slick, smooth, matinee idol Elwes we know from the likes of The Princess Bride. Or maybe I'm just easily fooled by someone dyeing their hair. Either way, with this and his turn as a shaggy PI in the Paramount Plus series MIA, Elwes is having something of a late blooming moment as a character actor. And so, when Dead Man's Wire hit Sky Cinema just the other week, I used it as an opportunity to leap onto a Zoom with the English actor and have a quick natter with him about, well, all of the above, and also working with his brother Cassian, who produced Dead Man's Wire. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the great Cary Elwes. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you, Chris. How are you?
I'm very, very good. Where in the world are you at the moment?
I am in Malibu.
Fantastic. Excellent stuff. Well, thank you for doing this. You have a wonderful kind of 1-2 punch. Dead Man's Wire is just about to hit Sky Cinema. It came out, obviously, in theatres a couple of months ago. And MIA is tearing it up as well on Paramount Plus at the moment. Both of which, I would say, Cary, you are not entirely recognizable as yourself, I would say initially. Certainly Dead Man's Wire, when I first saw it, I was like, where's Cary Elwes? For the first 10 minutes. That's a hell of a performance, a hell of a transformation, sir.
Thank you, Chris. It was a lot of fun to do. I love working with Gus Van Sant. He's a wonderful director. And if you look at his body of work, he's an exceptional filmmaker. And I kind of pitched him the idea of having me play the detective, because it's rare that I got offered to play the blue collar roles.
Yeah.
And he's based on a real person, obviously. And so I went down to Indianapolis and met with his family and gathered a lot of intel and came to work with a lot of things to play with. Yeah.
So he actually looks like the real guy? You looked like the real guy?
Yeah, that's the picture. We had a picture of him. He was an undercover narcotics agent, so he changed his look frequently, and that was the one. I showed that picture to Gus, and we both agreed that was a great look for him.
It is something of a family affair for you as well, because you work on it with your brother, Cassian?
Yes, I did. He produced the picture, and I kind of campaigned to be in it. Initially, he was a little resistant, but Gus was very, very nice about it. He called me and he said, I really want you to do this picture. So it was nice.
So Cassian didn't, he was resistant at first.
A little bit. I think that he didn't want to force Gus's hand. And I understand that from a producer's standpoint. but it all worked out.
Yeah. I don't think people are going to be leveling accusations at you of nepotism. I don't think.
Well, you know, he'd been wanting to work with Gus for a long time, and I understand that he didn't want to upset the apple cart, so to speak. And but like I said, it all worked out.
Over the years, you are a leading man, but were you also keen to kind of push the character actor part of yourself? And while you've played many wonderful characters over the years, are you excited now as you get older to maybe push that side of yourself a little bit more than perhaps you'd been allowed to in the past?
Yes, that's a very good observation, Chris. I do like to mix it up. And if I'm given an opportunity to do so, then I usually grab that opportunity.
How often do opportunities like that come your way?
I get to pick and choose now, so that helps a great deal.
Yeah, because it's been a really, really fascinating last few years for you. You know, watching your career, you've been obviously working with the likes of Guy Ritchie quite a lot, and Chris McQuarrie on the last two Mission Impossible movies. And what's that been like over the last few years? You know, getting to pick and choose and getting to do these really interesting projects with directors like that.
Well, it's I'm very grateful. To have the opportunity to work with extraordinary filmmakers has been a dream of mine. My whole, I think any actor, you know, worth their salt wants to work with talented people. And so, you know, getting to work with directors I've admired for a long time, I kind of, it's been something of a goal of mine to make myself find a way to get to these people in one way or another, to persuade them to let me work with them. But in most cases, they've come to me, which has been very gratifying.
Yeah, Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning. You play Denlinger, the I don't want to give too much away about that movie, but let's
sure,
just say
you can. It's okay.
Yeah, keep an eye on that guy, is what I would say.
He's the director of National Intelligence.
We are big fans of that movie and Chris McQuarrie.
Yeah, he's terrific, McHugh. He's great. He really is. Yeah, God, we had fun making that. It was so much fun. Yeah. And to work with Tom again after so many years was such a thrill.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you swap old Days of Thunder stories?
Yeah, you know, it's like no time has passed when you hook up with an old friend. It's great, you know.
What was the Days of Thunder experience like for you, just to go back to that one?
I was very young, Chris, you know. Let's see, I think it was in the early 90s, I think.
Yeah.
I was I auditioned for Tony Scott in New York. Mm. And Jerry Bruckheimer came into the room after the taping, and Tony had left to go discuss it with Don and Jerry. And Jerry came in and goes, "Okay, pack your bags. You're going to Daytona." And it was like that. And it was like being taken on a whirlwind journey of pure excitement. I had to learn how to drive NASCAR.
Uh-huh.
I was taught by some of the great NASCAR drivers, Kyle Petty, and amazing experience. And to be working with Tony, who I had a huge admiration for, and we became good friends, he was very, very similar to McHugh in many ways, very, very humorous,
yep,
and very smart, had a keen eye, and for both story and for camera. Just everything, just a really wonderful, sweet human being.
Yeah, he was absolutely terrific. I'm a huge fan of Tony Scott, and I had the pleasure of talking to him once, just once.
Yeah,
but he struck me as a really rock and roll kind of guy as well.
Very much so. Yeah, that's a good analogy. Yeah, he was all about his energy. Is really, when you look at his films, Top Gun, Days of Thunder, Man on Fire, all of them,
yeah,
they all have his energy, which is this, it's very kinetic, Chris.
Yeah.
You get caught up in it. And so everybody, if you look at his films, everybody's performances are a little bit heightened, you know? And he likes that theatricality.
Yeah.
But his personal charm was just extraordinary, and just completely overwhelmed everybody who got to work with him and meet him. He's just you get caught up in the Tony Scott whirlwind, you know, and it was great.
Let's talk about MIA. Again, this is a very, you know, very interesting, very, very different character for you. First of all, how did they come about? You know, how did the show come your way?
Well, the showrunner, Karen Campbell, approached me, and they said they'd written this role for me, and he's a ex-homicide detective from Miami turned private investigator, and he's a guy. He's on a journey to rediscover his moral compass, and I thought it was a very nuanced character. I really thought, okay, here's another chance for me to delve into something that's perhaps not in my comfort zone.
Yeah,
and yeah, great fun, great cast, and of course, it's, you know, it's the kind of entertainment you'd expect from Bill Dubuque, who gave us Ozark. You know, it's really an action-filled crime drama.
Yeah. You said there, you know, it's a chance to go outside your comfort zone. what do you consider your comfort zone as an actor to be?
Well, I think it's not, that's a good question. I guess I don't like, as you mentioned earlier, that I've been kind of searching for more character driven roles. It's easy for me to just, when someone says, oh, I want that leading man look, don't put any makeup now, just, you know, clean shaven, just your face. That for me is, it's a comfort zone, but it's also uncomfortable in that it's too comfortable. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I want to, if I get offered a role that I'm a little nervous about or unsure whether or not I can play it, that's usually the roles I kind of gravitate towards, Chris.
Do you find for a little bit as well after Princess Bride, although you've done a lot of dramatic roles, that maybe people were not just pigeonholing you because of your looks, but pigeonholing you because of comedy, and they wanted you to be the comedic guy or the upper class Brit in some ways?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I've turned a lot of those down.
Yeah.
Because the filmmakers are important to me. You know, if I can only really stretch myself if I'm in the hands of a great filmmaker. Yeah. You're only as good as the person who's behind the camera.
Yeah.
And the people you're acting with. And so if the cast is great, the writing is great, and the director's great, those are the three boxes that check for me.
Well, one last thing to talk about, which I think checks those boxes for you, is one of the next things you'd be doing, which is Very Young Frankenstein, or should I say, Harry, Very Young Frankenstein?
Frankenstein, yes.
Yeah, my pronunciation was very wrong there. That, I mean, obviously is reuniting you with Mel Brooks. You've got Taika Waititi on board that. Zach Galifianakis is on board that. Yeah. Sounds like a blast. What can you say?
Well, again, checks all those boxes. I've been wanting to work with Taika for a long time, a long time, ever since I saw Jojo. I just thought, this is a man I have to work with. And, you know, I loved his series, What We Do in the Shadows, as well.
Yeah.
And Zach, obviously, is a comedic icon and a joy, just a joy. We had I think we ruined a lot of takes on that show. A lot. Including Taika. Who has, we just had so much fun.
Well, I cannot wait to see that. And I'm going to let you go. But it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for your time. Well, that was Cary Elwes. And if you haven't seen Dead Man's Wire, it's available now on Sky Cinema. And also now, it's now on Now. That makes sense. Last but not least this week, here's one for you if you are one of the many, many people obsessed with obsession. Curry Barker's wild horror movie has become one of the biggest box office stories in years, capturing the public imagination and packing audiences in pretty much everywhere since it opened about 6 weeks ago. It's just hit the $300 million mark worldwide and the $200 million mark in the States alone, and it's still going strong, becoming along the way one of the most profitable films of all time, what with his budget of $750,000. We didn't speak to Barker when the movie came out, but as our obsession grew, so did our desire to have a chat with him, and we broke open a bunch of One Wish Willows, and our wish finally came true as we sat down with him on Zoom this week for a wide-ranging chat about the movie's success and some of its wilder plot twists and turns. That interview can be found in full over on our spoiler special feed, EmpireSpoilerSpecials.com, if you don't already subscribe. It's worth it for less than the price of a cup of coffee, or, if I speak in terms I can understand as a non-coffee drinker, roughly 4 bags of squashies every month. But right now, we're bringing you roughly the first half of that. Warning, spoilers abound, particularly towards the end. So if you haven't seen Obsession, be careful. So here it is, Ben Travis, our Ben Travis, talking to Curry Barker. Enjoy.
A huge welcome to the director of Obsession, Curry Barker. How are you doing, man?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. I saw this film a couple of weeks ago now, and it is burned in my brain. I can't even imagine what the last month or so has been for you. How, start to bring me into where you've been at for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. Right now, I'm trying to It's overwhelming, and so sometimes I have to just turn my phone off. Or but it's so crazy, and it's doing things that nobody. It's almost like, hey, I didn't ask for this. Like, I just wanted it to be a decently successful movie. I didn't know it was going to be breaking every record and whatever, and just. It's a lot to live up to, and so that can kind of start to get scary. But I'm just focusing on my next film and trying to keep my head down I'm in my room and just trying to pretend like nothing else matters, you know.
At the same time, as much as you're trying to kind of shield yourself a bit, stuff must be making its way to you. Who has got in contact to say, I love the film? Have there been any people who are like heroes of yours who have dropped you a line and said, holy shit, man?
Yeah, 100%. All my favorite people have pretty much reached out at this point. Bill Hader, Zach Kreger, Ari mm-hmm. Aster, Steven Spielberg, Paul Thomas Anderson, Quentin Tarantino, wow. Nathan Fielder. Awesome. Tim Robinson, who I love. just the list just goes on and on. I mean, there's Taron Egerton, who plays Eggsy in Kingsman and Elton John, like big fan. I'm a big fan of that guy. And he sent me this long voice message about how much he loved the film. And it's just like, it's insane, man.
He went beast mode this year at Apex. He went a bit Curry Barker there in that
movie.
Also, you mentioned Nathan Fielder and
Robinson.
Tim Robinson. A lot of your films, even your work obviously before Obsession, it feels like there's a lot to do with like social tensions and social boundaries. I can imagine what a combination between your horror instincts and their sort of propensity for poking at the edges of social interactions could result in.
Yeah. I love their work. I would love to collaborate with them. I don't know what in what capacity or what that looks like, but I would love to. Yeah.
So what was the moment when you realized that Obsession was really getting this kind of insane level of traction? Because it started high anyway, but it was that gravity-defying thing that basically very, very, very few films get, which is the numbers are climbing each week. What was the moment where you started to think, oh, wait, something is happening here that's not normal?
The Focus Features team and all the people around me were very good at managing my expectations, you know, doing the thing that you're supposed to do with directors, which is tell them that that it's okay and that no matter what the numbers are, don't worry, it doesn't matter. And so I was kind of given the lowest version of what this movie could do and kind of been told, like, this is what's going to happen. The second weekend it's going to drop and that's just normal. And it's so we were looking at like 8 or 9 million the first weekend as a projection. And so even just the first weekend when it hit 17 million, everyone was freaking out and was like, Curry, this is crazy. And I was like, and me, like, who wasn't really that educated. I'm not like, I never really followed box office numbers or stuff. So I wasn't like educated enough to know like what's good and what's not good. Now I've educated myself quite a bit, but I was like, oh, is 17 like great? Is 17 bad? And they're like, dude, it's insane. And so the next weekend, I was just ready. I was ready for it to drop. I was ready for it to be, you know, 10 or 15 or whatever. And it went to like 26 or something. And I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. And I started asking ChatGPT, like, what does this mean? And like, you know, trying to figure out, it's unbelievable. And really the cultural impact has been what's really shocking to me. Me and Cooper used to make videos that would parody things in pop culture. We made it like a Talk to Me video that blew up. So to see other creators doing that for my movie is really surreal.
It really struck me that the One Wish Willow element of the film, obviously it's a plot device, but also it does feel like an incredibly strong piece of iconography that already has a bit of a life outside of the film. When you were coming up with even just the name of it, it's really hooky, right? One Wish Willow, and how simplistic it is that it's a twig and you snap it and you snap and then the wish happens, down to the packaging, which I understand there was a family connection in creating that packaging. Did you know in putting that element of the film together that you were creating like a new little piece of horror iconography there?
The thing is, my mind only thinks, I think it's something to my benefit. I'm kind of, I think, like, as a dreamer and as a visionary storyteller, I always dream big. I've done it my whole life. I've always seen the biggest version of a thing. So yeah, when I was making the One Wish Willow, I saw the version of it that became a huge cultural phenomenon. I was like, dude, what if the One Wish Willow becomes this like thing that people, it be in pop culture, like it becomes a thing. Doesn't mean I actually thought that that was going to happen. Right. But of course I saw what I wanted it to be. And same thing with Anything But Ghosts. You know, I'm seeing it and I'm thinking, what if this is the next Ghostbusters? What if this is the next cultural, these two characters are people dress up as this for Halloween. And like, that's what I want for all the things that I do. And there's kind of an iconicness to the things I want to create. Mm. But no, I mean, you couldn't anticipate it to actually happen this way. If there's such thing as manifestation, I guess it works because I
will confess, I can't even remember the context, but I have messaged on the Empire WhatsApp. Some like weird film news came up and I said, right, who used the One Wish Willow to wish for this?
It feels like
it's already taking on a life of its own.
Right.
But in that sense, I mean, there's a gravitational pull to, as I said, the numbers going up and up. What do you think is causing people to rush out? What for you do you think is the success of the film, the thing that is making people flock to see it?
Honestly, I can only speak for myself and I can only speak for what makes me go see movies. And maybe that's why it's successful, is because I only ever made this movie for really me. Mm. Like, I always think about the audience. I'm constantly thinking about, what is the audience going to think about this? Are they going to understand this? Is this going to make sense? But I'm only thinking about if I was the audience member, like if I was. And so, when I go rush to see a movie, it's because my friends have told me that there's some crazy thing that happens. You have to see this in the theater. And so, if I think about why people are going to see it, it's the same reason that I kind of designed for people to want to maybe go see it. Because when I was making that, like, movies that make me excited are like Joker, or The Invisible Man, or Hereditary, or like these movies where people come home and they say, this movie's crazy and there's something crazy that happens in it that you have to see. Go watch this film. And I go see it. And then I Weapons, like, I was like, you have to, I told my friends, I was like, dude, Weapons is good. You have to go see it. And you end up going and seeing it a couple times because you want to bring a different friend to see it, or you want to see the reaction. And so I think that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. People want to bring their friends. People want to see it with their different friends. And And there's something catchy about the cultural, it's kind of becoming a meme, and like you almost feel left out if you haven't seen it. Like, but these are all things that you can't possibly anticipate. These are just things that are happening that are really helping the film. That it's, you know, so.
I mean, there are so many incredible sequences in the film. I think there are many scenes that are causing people to flock out. But if there's one that stands out to me in the screening that I was in, which was like a paid public screening, it's the Sarah death scene.
Yeah.
There was a guy on the row behind me who was literally yelling, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. He was like, the vibe in the cinema was absolutely electric. Have you seen that sequence with an audience? Have you sat in and watched
that? Oh, yeah. Yeah. I saw it at the festivals. I saw it at the special screenings. But I also I've gone in the wild and I put a hat on, some sunglasses. I walk, and I'll try to see a couple of them in the wild. So yeah, I mean, it's always fun to, and I'm kind of enjoying this, cause it's going to go like, it's not going to be in theaters forever. So I might have to just do it one more time, you know, before it's gone forever. So,
I mean, I think some of the genius of that moment is, and what's so incredible in the way you craft it is, you know, it's coming, you know, the internal logic of the film, the emotional logic of the film, this lovely, happy moment can't last.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, we know it's coming. And so there is an incredible buildup. And when it does kick off, it has to go hard. Yeah. And you went so hard in that moment. Was that your thought process behind it? That if we've got to do this, we have to do like the most 100% version of that head being smashed into the brick on the wheel?
Yeah. Like, I think I watch horror movies and I'm like, when I'm watching horror movies, I'm like, oh my God, like I want something crazy to happen right now. Like I'm watching a horror movie and I'm enjoying it for whatever it's worth, but I'm like, what if the director had something crazy happen right now? Like, what if this, like mid sentence, this thing just, you know? And so that's kind of what I wanted to do. I was like, we're having a chill moment here. And yeah, we all know Nikki's coming, but what if it's not just like she knocks on the window and is like, hello, like what if something just crazy happens? And so I wanted it to be fast. I wanted it to be in your face. That's kind of what I was going for.
And there you go. That was Curry Barker talking to Ben Travis about Obsession. Head over to our spoiler special feed for the rest of that interview, as well as Team Empire banging on about the movie in our spoiler special deep dive. Oh, and there's also about 500 plus other incredible spoiler specials, with more coming up soon on the likes of Steven Spielberg's Disclosure Day, Andrew Stanton's Toy Story 5, and Craig Gillespie's Supergirl. And on that note, that is it for this episode of The Interviews. Join us next time for more film chat related fun. In the meantime, I've got to go answer a loud banging at my front door. I'm sure it can't be connected to all those One Wish Willows I was just wantonly opening. Oh, maybe I got a whole box of squashies. I did wish for that. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.